Good evening.
Good evening.
Thank you. My name is Jason Rubenstein. I have the pleasure and honor of being a faculty member here at Yeshivat Hadar and have been learning with many of you over the past months and years. And I'm delighted to welcome you to the third and final installment of our series on the stranger, widow, and orphan. This has been Torah that we feel is obviously timeless and always relevant and feels particularly urgent in this city and in our country right now. And the way we've gone about kind of creating these sessions is to do so in dialogue with leading practitioners and activists. And so Tamar Fox has traveled here from Philadelphia to present tonight, and her really involvement in the thinking and the learning that will be on display tonight goes much deeper than that. The source sheet and the ideas that we'll be discussing really were generated through a series of conversations going back months, in some ways years actually, and we'll get to share that tonight in an evening of learning and discussion. The first half of the session, about 40 minutes, will be based on the source sheets in front of you. And the second half will be a dialogue between myself and Tamar, obviously with questions and thoughts from you all as well. So I want to just begin with a note, which is that all of us have experiences of, you know, wonderment and frustration, terror in the thing that is being a child, and for many of us being a parent, whether that's a biological parent, an adoptive parent, a foster parent. And I want to kind of put that on the table in the most direct way I can, which is by welcoming my parents who are here in attendance tonight. And just noting that there are, you know, people here who are adoptive children and who are adoptive parents, who are foster children. And one of the main things we'll be looking at is the ways that these varieties of experiences of being a child, a parent, a caregiver are paradigmatic and kind of critical for what it means to be a Jewish person. So I want to frame what we're thinking about here, the category of the orphan, the call to care for the orphan, which is one of the most prominent, repeated, forceful, incisive themes of the biblical message of justice, really begins, I think, from a meeting point of two kinds of human vulnerability and two kinds of human agency. The first of those vulnerabilities is the almost unimaginable vulnerability of the human infant. The incredible quantity and quality of care that was required for every single person who made it to adulthood to make it. I'll just share. The other day, my older son, whose third birthday is today, and I were watching a nature documentary on sea turtles. And the narrator was like really trying hard to sell how hard the mother sea turtle works to bed. And she climbs out of the water, she digs this hole, she lays 80 eggs, she goes back in the water, and she never sees them again. And she apparently, they know this from tracking sea turtles, she's lucky if one of them survives to adulthood. And it seemed to me that basically the amount of investment of energy in her 80 children was the equivalent of like one midnight visit to the ER. Right? Like, I mean, just kind of unfathomable when you actually think about the amount of human life that's devoted to caring for our little ones so that they can survive, you know, and thrive. That's the first kind of human vulnerability, which is kind of sets the stage for what we're talking about. The second is the vulnerability of caregivers, the fact that adults are not always safe, are mortal, are vulnerable to all kinds of dangers and social pressures and cannot always be the ones to care for their young in the way, our young, in the way we dreamed of and thought about. So there's a vulnerability of children and also a vulnerability of parents. And that's what sets the stage for the fact that there is such a thing as an orphan, as one who requires care of others. And there's two kinds of agency also. There's the fact that one, humans can provide this kind of care. It's an incredible ability that we have to invest in, to nurture, to raise the young of our families, of our species, of our community. And the second is the agency that is there not just in the caregivers, the primary caregivers of parents, but in others, right? In the people in their community who can step in voids, and in the children themselves who can create lives of resilience and of possibility that are not just the product of the conditions of childhood. And before we start, I hope you've already noticed the ways that we've moved through a lot of categories. We've talked already mentioned adoption, orphanhood, fostering. These are terms that we have because they're legal institutions and social institutions in our society. And we'll see kind of right off the bat that these are in some ways illuminating, in some ways obfuscating terms to bring to the tradition, because there are so many other possible configurations of caregiving and of families. And so I want to just name that really explicitly, that we can imagine and reflect a little bit, even as we're just beginning here, on the amount of care that was given to each one of us from our parents and from many others, as an attempt to kind of begin to chart out the map of possibilities here. So I want to start off with just a very short observation about the Bible, which we're here on page one here, which is it's very simple. The Bible in 18 places is the number I would put on it, gives normative, ethical, and legal instruction about the urgency of care for those who do not have adults to protect them. The language is the yatom or the yatoma. Now, this is a very specific kind of care because in 14 of those 18 places, so 75% of the time, the vast majority, the command that God and the prophets give is to protect the orphan from exploitation. And here's just one example which I want to show you so clearly. So we're in here in Sefer Devarim chapter 10, a line that becomes part of the Amidah. For the Lord your God is God supreme and Lord supreme, the great, mighty, and awesome God who shows no favor and takes no bribes. And watch now the opposition between the two halves of the following verse, but upholds the cause of the fatherless and the widow. It's actually a kind of under translation. The word is mishpat here. It's a legal word. It's a defender of, in the most kind of precise legal sense, defends the rights of the widow and the fatherless. And fatherless here is a very precise and good translation. In contrast to, look what follows, befriends the stranger, providing him with food and clothing. Right, the kind of economic vulnerability, the lack of access to the means of subsistence, which is associated with the stranger, perhaps better, refugee, is not the condition of the fatherless and the widow here. It's a vulnerability to predation that God steps in to protect them from. And you can see this here, that fatherlessness is the correct word here in the following passage from Exodus, where the word yatom is really precisely rendered as someone who is fatherless. You shall not ill-treat any widow or orphan. If you do mistreat them, God here is speaking to the male congregation of the Israelites, I will heed their outcry of the widow and the orphan as soon as they cry out to me. My anger shall blaze forth, and I will put you, the men, to the sword, and your own wives shall become widows and your children orphans. So I just want you to think for a moment about that image here. Right? These children have mothers who are still alive, and the term orphan is properly applied to them in this context. Does that make sense? Right. The father has died for his sins in this account, and the child is therefore an orphan. In other words, the role that kind of is described here and is highlighted here again and again in the Bible by the use of these legal terms is a protective role, right? A protection against those dangerous, exploitative, predatory forces of society. It is not a nurturing role. That makes sense? The command is not generally to be merciful to the orphan. It's not to be kind to them. It's not to share one's resources with them. It's not to kind of care in a nurturing way, in a way that's often, as we'll see in some of these sources, actually gendered female. It's a kind of a classically male role. In this sense, it's very kind of natural for, in one moment in Psalms, for God to be called Avi Yatomim, right? The father, specifically, of orphans, right? There's a certain kind of picture here of what it means to be bereft of a father in that kind of picture of what that social role was. That moment is really in contrast to how Chazal, how our rabbis see what it means to relate to children who've lost a parent and what those children need. So now I want to pivot to the second side of the source sheet here. And we're going to look at two sources, which are really the two central Talmudic moments in thinking about this life, this situation of a yatom, of an orphan. And interestingly, you'll note, neither of these works off the several dozen verses in the Bible about orphans, right? In thinking about what it means to care for children who do not have caregivers, Chazal actually do not begin from the Bible's treatment of children who do not have caregivers. They start from a different place because they can see the problem differently. They kind of see the role and the lack in a different way. So we'll start from one of those other places here in Psalm 106. And after we get through this source, we're going to pause and take a few questions just to make sure that this first piece has all come together. Okay, Psalm 106 verse 3 reads as follows. Happy are they who keep justice, who perform charity at all times. And the kind of the moment, the midrashic opportunity that's opened up here is, well, how can you perform charity at all times? Like sometimes you're sleeping. Sometimes you're eating breakfast. Although if you're a parent of small children, you may never get to breakfast. I saw a great post by a friend, Sarah Mulhern, on Facebook where she said, you know, things I accomplished this morning, pouring bowl of cereal. Things I did not accomplish this morning, folding the laundry, eating bowl of cereal, pouring milk into bowl of cereal. Right? Sometimes you are constantly engaged in care. And that's actually the force of the Gemara here. What does it mean to perform charity in every moment? Oset tzedakah b'chol eit. So the Gemara quotes this. Happy are those who keep justice, who perform charity at all times. But is it possible to perform charity at all times? Charity is a discrete set of acts, right? You sit down once a month and you press donate on a website. You encounter three people on their way to work and you give them money or food. So we have two opinions, of course. Our rabbis in Yavne taught, and some say it was Rabbi Eliezer, this refers to someone who feeds his sons and daughters when they are little. So this is a fascinating moment here where charity, tzedakah, right, which is normally associated with an altruistic moment, a giving at a distance, is said to reach its pinnacle in one's home. Right? And the idea, actually, it turns out when you're sleeping, you're doing child care also because you've got to be at home in case someone wakes up. You are constantly caring. That's the first picture, right? This, the one who is in some ways the most perfect doer of tzedakah, performer of tzedakah, is a parent, an attentive, involved, nurturing parent. Rav Shmuel bar Nachmani is not totally happy with it. He says, no, who's doing tzedakah b'chol eit, constantly doing charity, refers to someone who raises an orphan, the boy does not belong there in the translation, raises an orphan in his house and marries them off. Right? This is actually someone who, and marries them off is right, you send them to college, right, would be our kind of equivalent to that. Yes?
The Hebrew seems to say a boy or a girl.
Right, so interestingly, the Hebrew seems to have yatom v'yatoma. I tried to cut that out unsuccessfully in English and just make it gender neutral because I think for us the distinction maybe doesn't feel so large, whereas for them I think it felt larger.
But orphan boy is very specific.
Right, so that's why it was a poor editorial job on my part. So here, Rav Shmuel bar Nachmani seems to be saying, right, raising your own children, come on, raising your own children doesn't count as tzedakah. Like, who's going to care for you when you're old? Your kids, right? Who are you more narcissistically invested in the world? Your kids, right? Like, it's a little bit too self-serving. You have to get someone who's not related, someone whose relationship you've chosen, someone whose care is not kind of imposed on you. That can qualify as tzedakah. And so you have both the preservation of the kind of the distance and the altruism that we often associate with tzedakah and the constancy and intensity of child care in someone who raises those who have no one to raise them. And just to be clear here, the picture is not someone who protects orphans. It's not someone who's in family court. It's not someone who's like busting child labor rings, right? Those were all the biblical picture, right? Oseh mishpat, right? Someone who secures justice. This is someone who, as we'll see later, for human beings and for God, performs what's classically more gendered as a maternal role. Someone who cares, someone who nurtures. In this language, someone who feeds is the first piece. So I want to just pause at this moment. We'll see another example of it, but just to be clear up till now what we've seen, which is the Torah gives a kind of a judicial, a justice-focused picture of what it means to protect those who have no one to protect them. And Chazal take a different angle of what it means to care for people who have no one to care for them, for children. So just to be clear, questions or comments up to this point here before we move on a little bit deeper into Chazal? Okay. Shocked. Yes, and tell us your name.
Mary, this is kind of a segue, but is it true, I seem to remember hearing that somewhere in the Talmud it says that a teacher who is sitting Shiva doesn't have to but there's an exception. If the children need a teacher, she doesn't have to sit as long. Is that true?
So, yeah, well, and tell us the connection, because there are many interesting connections between the teacher sitting Shiva, possibly, and...
Because it's also about caring for children responsibly.
Yes. So the role of teachers is often, let me say this way. If, in as much as adoptive parents can be kind of the competitors or the possible alternatives to biological parents, teachers are the other main competitor or alternative. And we'll actually see a discussion that comes up in just this context. And the sitting of Shiva is really an interesting moment where, you know, to turn this back around, mourning is kind of required or legislated, not just for one's parents, but also for one's teachers. And then interesting questions arise around other people who cared for you. I don't know if any of you have ever done this. It's extremely moving to Google saying Kaddish for adoptive parent. And what you find is tshuva after tshuva after tshuva from, you know, every kind of contemporary Orthodox organization that has a website on the internet that says, the way to think about this issue is that in the late 40s and the 50s, person after person after person came to rabbis saying, the family that took me or my parents in the Holocaust has just lost one of its members, you know, someone who risked their life to save us. Can I sit Shiva for them? Can I say Kaddish for them? And the answer is always yes. Some form of mourning is not just appropriate, not just permitted, but probably even required. So I just want to invoke that as one other example to think now about the kinds of moments when parents can't guarantee the safety of their children, can't care for them, and other people step in to really supplement that role and provide that care and protection. Other thoughts and questions before we move on? Yes, and tell us your name.
Brian, I heard a lecture maybe 20 years ago, and it was by an ultra-Orthodox rabbi, and he said that adoption doesn't exist in Judaism because there are issues of yichud with parents of the opposite sex. I was wondering, and that's as far as I know, I was wondering if that is still considered a contemporary issue and how it was dealt with in biblical and Talmudic terms.
Let's go on to the next source. So the next source is going to be, I just want you to, we're going to read through it and it's going to read like gibberish to you. And I want to share with you, I first learned this source 13 years ago in yeshiva. I've learned a lot of Torah since then. It also reads like gibberish to me when I go through. I was up till 12:30 last night working on it. It's going to read like gibberish to me right now when I read through. I just want, we're going to make it through together. Don't give up when it's tough at first. Okay. So now we're in Divrei Hayamim. I think we call it One Chronicles nowadays. And we are in a set of genealogies of people. What's confusing about, if you know anything about the Bible, is that, one out of every four people listed in these genealogies is familiar, which makes it very strange that you've never heard of the other three, since they were, ostensibly their family members. And you, thought there were plenty of genealogies in the Torah. So, that's what's strange here. We're talking here about the line of Caleb, and his Yehudia, his Jewish wife, bore Jared, father of Gedor, Hevers, father of Socho, Yekutiel, father of Zanoach. These were the sons of Bitya, daughter of Paro, whom Mered married. Okay. So the first thing you need to know, Bitya, daughter of Paro, that's our ringer here for a couple reasons, one of which is she's one of the few women mentioned in this genealogy. And second, because we actually know about a daughter of Paro from the Torah, right, who goes into the river and disobeys her father's command. Right? She sees an Israelite boy. Her father has just said a minute ago, kill all the Israelite boys. And what does she do? She saves the Israelite boy. Exactly. If you want to read an amazing treatment of this, Professor Tikva Freimer-Kensky of Blessed Memory, in her book, Women of the Bible, points out that Paro, in his decree to kill all the boys, ignores the existence of the girls, of the daughters. He kind of thinks they're irrelevant. And then what happens? He's undone by a bunch of daughters, right? Miriam and his own daughter basically conspire to defeat him. It's this kind of amazing moment there. So this, we have this story. These are the sons of Midrashika, the daughter of Paro. Okay. The other thing you need to know for how this verse is read is that all those sons, it looked like there were maybe four. Those are all names for Moses. Okay, that was not obvious to you or me, but let's grant that for the moment, for the purposes of discussion. Okay, here we go. When Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi opened a lesson in the Book of Chronicles, he would say, all of your words, that really should be capital Y, all of your words, God, are one, and we know how to expound them. Doesn't mean actually it's like the Torah, despite its appearances of being contradictory and of giving different accounts of things, is actually unified, and we know how to get there. Or really more than we know how to kind of harmonize the Torah in a sense of just working out the rough patches, we know how to harmonize it in a musical sense, right? Of taking, when the Torah plays two notes that are dissonant, we strike a third note to make a chord, right? That's the picture of what you're going to see here. Okay, so the acknowledgement is that the story we just had in Divrei Yamim in Chronicles is very different than anything we knew from the Torah. And specifically here, that Bitya, the daughter of Paro, is described as the mother of Moshe. That's what has just happened in the story, right? These are the children, these being the names for Moshe, are the children of Bitya. She's the mother of this of Moshe. Okay, how did this happen? Turn with me to page 3. Why is she, Bitya, referred to as Yehudiah, right? Why is she Jewish, right? I thought everyone in the Book of Chronicles was Jewish. Because she repudiated idol worship, as it is written, the daughter of Paro came down to wash herself in the river, and Rabbi Yochanan said she went down to wash herself from the idols of her father's house. So it's actually imagined that this is a conversion scene, which is in some sense totally pshat, right? She at this moment rejects her father and everything he stands for. So it's not actually so crazy to say this is a moment of a clean break in the creation of a new identity, which includes a religious identity, not just an ethical one. Okay, so that's why she's called Yehudia. She's a Jew, a Jew by choice, as it were. She, yes.
You're obviously referring to Bithya.
Yes, yes, that's right, Bithya or Bithya, yes. So then the Gemara asks, she bore Moses, but didn't she just raise him, right? We know, right? Moshe is from Israelite lineage, not Egyptian lineage. Rather, and then this gets to your question, this tells you that anyone who raises an orphan in her house, the Torah considers it as if she gave birth to them. So i.e., just to be clear, right, the Torah that we have in the book of Exodus seems to make it say that Bitya raised Moshe. In Divrei Yamim in Chronicles, if you read it in the right way, it looks like Bitya gave birth to Moshe. How can that be? That dissonance is coming to teach you that those two ideas are actually much more closely related than you might have thought. There's not some strong opposition between creating babies and raising children. Actually, the terms for one can be used for the other. There's a parallel Gemara in Sanhedrin about Michal and her children. But the picture here, just to be clear, what emerges from this is a strong statement that it seems like there is such a thing as adoption. If you were to just take this in its fullest vein, right? There is such a thing as adoption. If you raise children, it's like you're their parent. The Torah treats you as their parent. Did you have your hand up back there? Okay. So I want to pause for just a moment because there's something happening here that's a little bit implicit, but it's very, very strongly implicit, and I want to make it explicit here. At this moment, when we're focusing on the significance of, and I'll call it foster care or adoption, it's not exactly clear which we'd call it. Again, our categories don't quite fit. We're focusing on the significance of foster care and adoption. We're not just saying that the Torah speaks about orphans, right, as some group of people who are out there who need to be cared for. The Torah doesn't even just go the step beyond that and say, well, some of us were orphans. Some of us were cared for by others. The Torah was written by someone who was an orphan, who was raised in foster care by adoptive parents. Right? And this is the play. When the Torah considers those who raise a child like those who gave birth to them, what we're saying on some level is that Moshe considered his Bitya, the daughter of Paro, who raised him, to be like a second mother. Right? The Torah there is not just an abstract document. It derives from a person. And that person inhabits this category. Right? If you can't really think of a way of making the experience of being cared for by others and raised by others more central than ascribing it to Moshe Rabbeinu. Yes?
You know that Moshe, of course, wasn't really an orphan.
Say more.
He had parents.
Ah.
He had parents.
Yes, so this is very interesting. The criterion here, I want this to be really clear, the criterion here is not about whether biological parents are alive, it's whether there are people who are capable of fulfilling these kind of twin functions of protecting and caring for. And that Moshe did not have, right? Moshe's Israelite parents could not protect him, right? And it's actually meaning to think about, for a moment, the most perfect fulfillment we have in the Bible of the Bible's command to protect the orphan is done by Pharaoh's daughter. Protect the one who has no one to protect them, to protect the one who has greater social forces arrayed against them, the child who has greater social forces arrayed against them. That's this story. So what I want to just make sure to kind of draw out here is this kind of gender piece, which has been somewhat implicit here, is now very, very explicit, right? The paradigm of caring for an orphan is Paro's daughter, right? Is not God who is the father of orphans, but Paro's daughter who becomes this boy's mother and hires a nurse for him. And this is this shift that I want to be really clear, right? This shift of kind of a paradigm that starts with, in the Torah, the concern about exploitation and the sense that there needs to be this paternal role to protect a child who has resources. It's an older child we're talking about, whether they can be exploited for labor, whether they have resources that they could be kind of swindled out of. We have an older child who's vulnerable, and they're kind of a relationship with a father-type figure is what the Torah thematizes. When you get to Chazal, you have a child who the picture is they're somewhere much younger, right? Moshe Rabbeinu is 3 months old at this point, according to the story. Or we have, right, someone who's raising children and feeding them, right? You have a story that begins at orphan scene is kind of gendered in this way cast more maternally. That shift in how kind of orphanhood is conceived and how provision of care is conceived in terms of the gap of what is most urgently missing when parents are missing or empowered parents are missing is the closest parallel I know to it is in the trajectory of 20th century psychoanalytic theory. The in Freud, the kind of the main relationship with parents is the Oedipal conflict, which happens with a child of a boy, so maybe 3 to 6, who's kind of encountering this father figure, a figure of power, a figure of discipline, a figure of restraint, and is kind of in conflict with that authority figure, and through that conflict becomes constituted as an independent adult. In the latter half of the 20th century, with figures like Klein and Winnicott, the focus of psychoanalytic thinking moves to earlier, to infancy, and the critical relationship shifts to the child and the mother. So you have a shift, basically, of back in time from, say, age 5 to age 3 months, and you have a kind of a shift from the father to the mother as the dominant figure. And I want to suggest you have something very similar happening here in the Torah. Right? You begin with this kind of picture of older children who need to be protected by a missing father, to a picture of younger children who need to be cared for by a missing mother. I mean, it's like a kind of a striking parallel. I think there are some reasons we could guess as to why that happens. So now I want to get to one last moment in this vein, and then there's one more source after this I want to look at before we wrap up this phase and enter into dialogue. So this is Rav Shlomo Kluger, one of the great figures of modern Torah scholarship, who raises the question kind of explicitly in almost a halachic manner, working off of the premise that Jewish adults, we'll use the gender-neutral language, Jewish adults have an obligation to produce children biologically. That's kind of the default assumption he's working on the background of. And that's the obligation of being fruitful and multiplying. So he says here, I'm not sure if someone who raises an orphan in her home is considered as having fulfilled the obligation to be fruitful and multiply. We're talking about now, what's the identity of a caregiver? Is it the same as the identity of a parent? Is it as much as the identity of a biological parent? For Chazal said, anyone who raises an orphan in her house, the Torah considers it as if she gave birth to them. So we could say that they fulfilled their obligation, if you kind of cash in that as if fully. But perhaps it isn't really like they gave birth to them, so they haven't fulfilled their obligation. How strong is that as if? Right? Is it an equal sign or a kind of slightly less than? So now we'll see that develop. This seems to depend on the debate between Rabbi Yehoshua Falk and Rabbi David Halevi Siegel in Yoredeya. So these are two kind of late 16th century, early 17th century figures commenting on the Shulchan Aruch, and they're actually talking about obligations to parents and to teachers. Rabbi Falk thinks that as if means that the thing being described is not exactly like what is being compared to, i.e., it's as if you gave birth to them, if you care for them. But not quite the same. There's a gap that kind of can never be bridged. But Rabbi Siegel disagrees and thinks that as if is a full equation. So therefore, on Rabbi Siegel's account, there is such a thing as adoption, and it equals and perhaps kind of supersedes or overrides biological parenthood. And the idea is, which I think is really, let's finish this passage and then we'll parse it out. Therefore, Rabbi Falk thinks that since they aren't entirely equal, raising children and birthing them, so when we say as if she gave birth to them, it's not real birth, and the obligation hasn't been fulfilled. But Rabbi Siegel thinks that this is full equation, and the obligation of having children has been fulfilled. So there's two notes I want to make on this. The first is there is an ambiguity, and a kind of intrinsic ambiguity in this phrase, raising a child who is not biologically related to oneself is as if you gave life to them. That phrase is ambiguous and it permits of different interpretations, which I want to suggest those interpretations can be as diverse as the relationships that are described in this. What I mean by that is you could imagine some relationships, some adoptive relationships, some fostering relationships, that for the parent and perhaps the child really do feel as full as their biological parent relationship, maybe more so, for maybe there's no significant difference. And you could also imagine other ones where there's a gap that can never be bridged, right? There's just a difference, right? You're not, I'm thinking of many movies like this, right? You're not really my parent, right? That phrase. And so what I want us to see here, the first thing is that the ambiguity of the tradition here, I think, maps nicely onto the complexity and diversity of human relationships as they are here. The second thing is that there's two possibilities that are surfaced in this exchange, just to put it kind of quantitatively. One is that adoptive relationships are equal to biological relationships that also include caring. And one is that adoptive relationships will always be somewhat less than, just to put it kind of comparatively in that way. That contrasts to, and I want this to be really clear, the opinion we saw from Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani, who said that actually in terms of evaluation of fulfillment of tzedakah, of the kind of the person who's the most giving, adoptive relationships transcend and are greater than biological relationships. Does that make sense? We have actually kind of all three possibilities mapped out at this point. What we saw when we were discussing tzedakah is the assertion, at least on Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani's part, that adoption and fostering are greater than biological parenting. We have a statement of equality and we have a statement of less than. And what I want to suggest is that those shouldn't be taken as pick one of those three that you like the best, but they're probably each true in different ways, in different relationships, right? They provide a kind of a way of talking about and parsing out what has been kind of supererogatory, what has been a gift, what has been kind of unexpected and maybe even heroic, something that has been totally normal, right? Saying it shouldn't matter. I shouldn't have to know whose kids are adopted and whose aren't. We're just all parents here. And in other ways that there are kind of gaps that can't be made up in care and relationships. And that all three of those kind of find their home in this piece. I want to teach one more text now, and I want to do it by telling the story. And I want to then wrap up and shift to dialogue here. So this is a story. It's on pages 4 and 5 of your source sheet. And the text that it's working off of, that it has in the back of its head, is the line from Shirat Hayam, from the Song at the Sea. Ze'e li va'anvehu Elohei aviv aron menhu. Right? This is my God. Someone says, this is my God, and it's also the God of my father. But there's a sense in like recognizing, it's like, oh, I know that God. Oh, my parents also told me about this being. So how would you get to that point? So here's the imagination. Pharaoh decreed that all the newborn boys would be killed. So what did the expecting mothers do? When they started to go into labor, they would make their way out into the fields, and they would give birth there. And then they would look up at the heavens, and they say, God, you said be fruitful and multiply. I did my part. Now you do yours. They would, like, go back to their homes. And the Egyptians would be watching. Like, they were wise to this. So they would kind of, like, chase after this newborn to kill it. And God would swallow the newborn up into the earth, just as the Egyptians were together, and they would like pop up a few hundred feet away. And so the Egyptians would like give chase to that newborn, and he would be like sucked up again and like pop up over there. The Egyptians would give chase. It's like this kind of game of whack-a-mole that they could never win. Eventually, they would like get tired and bored, and they'd go home, and the newborn would survive. But then what happens, right? There's like, you have an infant in the middle of the kind of wilderness. And now a debate ensues about whether God appointed angels to care for this baby, to feed it, and to wash and clothe it, or whether God's self did so, whether God personally attended to each child. Let me just finish the story, and then I'll get to your question. And pictures then after a period, it's not clear, a period of months or a period of years, God would lead the child back to their home, point the way and say, this is your home, and this is your mother's name, and this is your father's name, and would drop them off. And this child would walk into their home, and their parents would say, who raised you? And the child would say, this wonderful, beautiful man, he's right outside. And the parents would open the door and peek out, and no one was there. And then, when these little children saw God appear at the splitting of the sea, they said, that's the one who raised me. Ze'eli, Anfehu. They finally said, that's the one, right? They could say to their parents, you were looking for him. That's who he is. So this story, which I first heard from my colleague, Rabbi Eli Comfort, I find to be like extremely moving for many reasons. But I just want to point out here that this is two things about this story. First is God as a foster parent. Right? This is something I would have never realized about this midrash were it not for my conversations with Tamar. Right, this is fostering is imitatio Dei. Again, the parents have not died in the story. The parents are here, they exist, but for kind of social and political reasons, they do not have the means to protect and care for their children, and someone else, in this case God, must step in and do so. And the second thing is that on the logic of this story, this is our story, right? This is how every single Jewish child was raised in Egypt. Right? We are all, if we trace it far back enough, foster children with God as our parent, in addition to our parents who raised and cared for us the other years of our lives. And I think this is a picture here, if you have one picture of kind of othering, you know, there are those children who need to be taken care of. And on the other extreme is Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Our great exalted leader is himself an orphan, a child who is raised by others. This is a picture, this is all of us. Like every single one of us, this is our story. This is what it means to be a Jewish person, is to trace your lineage back to a time when your own parents could not take care of you, your family couldn't take care of you, and you needed God to step in. Yes, you've been waiting to comment.
So you mentioned Hashem or the angel. It doesn't matter. It's irrelevant, okay? According to the Shem, of course, for who Hashem directed, he himself told the angels to protect the children, the child, okay? All right? Bithya? She was rewarded. She was allowed. I base it on the Tom Heston. She was committed to accompany
yes. The
children of Israel for the Exodus and make it to Mount Sinai.
Right. So, it's on one level, I agree. And tell us your name.
Stuart.
So on one level, right, it doesn't matter whether it's God or angels. God's running the whole show, you know, whatever. It's like, on the other hand, this is a question, you know, our older son had his 3-year checkup today. It's like, well, do you go to your kid's checkup or does your nanny go, right? Like there's a difference there, right? Like, and it makes a difference in terms of what the experience is for the kid and for you and the relationship. So even though, right, they made it through the checkup either way, there are fundamental choices there. And the idea is that some members of Chazal are not willing to accept the picture of God as the one who kind of runs the show and leaves the caretaking to others. The insistence is like caretaking is not just work for less important people to do. Caretaking is God's work, right? It's an amazing thing. Like every time everyone gives a baby a bath, they're walking in God's ways, right? That's the kind of the gauntlet that this midrash throws down. Yeah, Ben?
Just going back into the source from Kama Bavli, and you had said this is sort of a paradigm of how the highest level of charity is actually raising the orphan. But maybe another way to look at it is that the rabbis are sort of one-upping Rav Shmuel Bar Nachmani is one-upping the others and saying, like, okay, so in addition to raising your two children, you also have to raise an orphan and you have to marry the orphan off. It's like an elevated level without sort of saying which one is better than the other.
So it's right, in addition to rather than in place of. That I think is possible. It would have been nice if there was a gam or an off in the right, some sense of addition rather than replacement here. And I do also want to you know, point out, I think this is like a very powerful picture of the ways different, say this way, we've been talking about like care of children. There's also the identity of grown-ups, right, which is kind of implied by this, have I fulfilled an obligation? So the sense that on your reading or the rabbi's reading, the only way you fulfill the obligation to kind of move the path, give it forward in this life is by having your own children is like one picture. That's the ideal way to do it. There's another which says there are many paths forward, and actually investing deeply in the care of children is enough, period. Right? That's like an insistence, like there's not necessarily a privileged path forward. Great. I'll take one more comment, and then I'm going to invite Tamara up here for our dialogue. Yeah.
But there seems to be two very different concerns. The ones from Barham and Schmug are about being concerned about the ill care.
Yes.
And that something bad would happen because they're of a different status. And then when you switch to Chazal, it's more about sort of the mitzvah and the good that you'd be doing. So the concerns are totally different.
Yes. So I think that is exactly, the concerns are different, and I'll kind of wrap up with this observation here, just by way of signaling. The last part of the source sheet, which we're not going to get into because of time, is from an amazing article that's forthcoming by Professor Dina Aronoff at GTU, where she argues, you would love this article, Susan, that something has kind of been missed by biblical linguists up to today, which is that the root Aleph Mem Nun, which has two meanings in biblical Hebrew, one of which is to have faith in and belief in and trust, and the other of which is to provide nursing care for children, those two meanings are related. And in a deeper way, it's an objective correlative, right, to use T.S. Eliot's language, right, that the capacity for trust, and this is, you know, Winnicott and many other psychologists, the capacity to trust, the capacity to believe, the capacity to have hope, all those things that are emunah, is grounded in an experience of having been cared for reliably and faithfully in one's infancy. And one of the moments, and this is, I think, the kicker here for your point, she says, well, people might object that the use omein of to care for children is only attested maybe five or six times in the Bible. She says, okay, but there's actually only like seven or eight scenes of caring for children in the Bible. Right? So the majority of them use this word. And what that gets to is that the scale of the kind of vision of the Torah is an epic scale, right? It's of concerns of justice at a society-wide level. Chazal don't have the luxury and the burden of kind of seeing on the level. They're thinking, they have families, they have people, they have tight-knit communities, and they're thinking about what it takes for those communities to like move forward. So now I want to invite Tamara up. We're going to sit up here on the stage. I prepared a bunch of questions, and I'll just, as you come, I'll read your biography because you deserve it, and because it's so great. I have it right here. Tamara Fox is a writer and editor. By day, she works for the city of Philadelphia to create a city website that isn't terrible. And by night, she's a step-parent, foster parent, community organizer, and essayist. On Shabbat, she's a gabbai and organizer of Minyan Tikva, an independent minyan in Center City, Philadelphia. Tamara was a fellow at Yeshivat Hadar in 2007 and is the author of No Baths at Camp, a PJ Library book. And I just want to say, Tamara, it's such a delight to, in every sense, to have you here. In all of these roles are things that I think come very naturally to you, which is, makes me very envious. And it's really in the capacity to speak to all of them that we're so lucky to hear from you tonight. So.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It is an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Great. So start off telling us about, how did you come to be a foster parent? What do you do as a foster parent?
So it was interesting when you talked about the people, if you Google, can you say Kaddish for an adoptive parent, that it really responses from that come from the Holocaust, because my grandfather was born in Vienna in the 20s, and he was a teenager in 1938 when it started to be very dangerous to be a Jewish person in Vienna, and so he was able to get a spot on the Kinder transport as a 16-year-old in 1938, and he got out and went to England, and he lived with a foster family, the Adlers, in London, who saved his life. I mean, he probably would not have survived without that. And My mom grew up very, very steeped in the knowledge. I think that the fact that she existed was because of this act of chesed that this, you know, stranger to her grandfather, to her father, did. And so that was like really, I think, a deep essential part of my mother's identity. When my mother was like 24, she was a newlywed, and she and my dad, who, I mean, he was a grad student and she was a social worker, so they were rolling in cash. They sponsored a couple of teenage Vietnamese refugees who, at the time they were called Vietnamese boat people. I think that's maybe not the term that we would use now, but teenage siblings, Mai and Tai, and my parents took them in to their house and put them up and got them started at school, and my dad actually got Tai a job, and Tai still works where at the job that my dad got him 40 years later or something, and they were really successful, own homes, and Mai died a while ago, unfortunately, but Tai owns a business and whatever. It really put them in a really good situation to succeed in their own lives. And I don't actually even know, come to think of it, if they were orphans, but they were refugees for sure. And I don't think that doing that was something that my parents thought about that much later, but it was definitely something that my mom did out of a sense of obligation that her father was alive because someone had done something similar. And I feel that way very much too, that, you know, I happen to be somebody who's really lucky and has had a lot of people help me in my life, and being a foster parent seems like a way of using that to help other people. And I feel very aware that, like, I would not exist if it hadn't been for this family in London who didn't know anything about my grandfather saving his life. And I think that's kind of like how I got into fostering. My partner has a like less intense story, but his family growing up took in some families that were in having a hard time. They had a guest house behind their house, and so they often had families coming through who were going through some kind of hard time, and his family would take care of them. And so for both of us, it felt kind of like just a natural thing to try out. What it is like to foster is, I could say, like, the really dramatic thing that happens is you get a baby with a child with essentially no notice. So our first placement, it was a Friday. I was cooking Shabbat dinner. We were having some friends over for dinner. It was 6 o'clock. I got a call. They said, "Do you want to take a baby? She's just being released from the hospital today. She's a newborn." And I said, "Yes." And they said, "Okay, we'll call you in a few hours and we'll be right over." And so that was at 6 o'clock, and she arrived at 9 o'clock. So there's not like, it's not like, I mean, it actually was later pointed out to me that we started the process of becoming foster parents 9 months earlier. So it was like, if I had gotten pregnant on that day, I might have given birth like on the day that we got a child. But it doesn't always take, you know, whatever. You never know when you're gonna get a call. And so both times that we've had children placed with us, it's been this very dramatic, like, one morning you wake up and you don't have any kids in your house, and the next morning you wake up with a newborn. And then everything after that is just parenting for the most part, and it's not super dramatic, but I will say that it is. I'm also a step parent, and in a way step parenting is parenting by committee, because you have other people that you are taking into account when you're making decisions about your child, and foster parenting is very much like that, because the child has parents who are involved in some decisions, and also there's a whole legal structure that's involved, and so there are social workers. We have social workers visiting our house, it seems like, every day, and there are court dates, and there are some kind of more bureaucratic elements that are involved, I would say 90% of the time they have little impact on our lives. That has, I think, something to do with the specifics of the situations in which we've been involved in. In some cases, there can be a lot more involvement of the bureaucracy. But for the most part, our life is really just regular parenting, with the caveat that we're also trying to always make room for another person. So, like, in the case of both of my foster daughters, we worked really hard to, it's helpful to have Hebrew, because I can be Ima and there can also be Mommy, and there doesn't need to be like competing mommies. And actually just yesterday when I was picking my foster daughter up from daycare, there was a new person working at the daycare, and I walked in and my daughter was saying, Ima, Ima, and the woman was like, no, that's Mommy. And I was like, no, that's not Mommy. I mean, I don't really care if she calls me Mommy, but she knows who her Mommy is, and she calls her Mommy, Mommy, and she calls me Ima. And so she wasn't wrong. She knew who I was. But I think that, like, we work really hard to make sure that we are leaving room for whatever relationship our daughter ends up having with her mom, and creating as much of one as we can safely and comfortably do. Comfortably is not the right word. I wouldn't say it's comfortable, but as we can accommodate at this point, and just assuming that, like, when she gets old enough, she'll have more of a say in it. But for now, we're really committed to making sure that, like, our parenting of her is not in any way boxing out her having a relationship with her mom. Mm.
Wow. So given that kind of, the committee, I guess, is one language for it, but that seems such a, you know, kind of so bureaucratic compared to what you describe, which is these relationships that are going to be developing over time. I'm really curious, from the learning we did over the last 45 minutes, what really jumped out at you as a useful or an interesting image or association?
I think that the idea of, like, is it greater than or equal to or slightly less than, is adopting or fostering as a equal to or slightly less than parenting a child that you have biologically. And I think that, like, at least in my experience, there's just no way to know. Like, you know, I don't have any biological children, so I can't say, like, that it is or isn't different. But I do feel like it's going to be 15 to 18 years until Adira can tell us, is it the same or greater than or less than whatever connection she has with her mom and or her dad. And I think that, like, that's not a very satisfying answer, but I also think that's just kind of how the world is. Like, some people have really great relationships with their parents. I had a really wonderful relationship with my mom, but, like, some people have really terrible relationships with their parents, and it doesn't have, I don't think, that much to do with biology. It's just, like, kind of how things turn out. And so I understand the want and need from a legal perspective to be like, this is a parent and this person isn't a parent. In fact, there's a great article in this week's New Yorker about what legally constitutes a parent. And it is really interesting, but it also, from the perspective of somebody who, like, does a lot of parenting and is not, like, currently legally recognized as a parent, like, that's not actually that important to me. Like, it's not important to me, but at the end of the day, like, my job is, like, changing diapers and doing daycare drop-off and, like, making sure that she has the right size shoes next month when her feet are bigger. Like, that's my real job, and, like, at someday when she's older, she'll tell me if, like, I did well or not. But I can't, if I spent all of my time being concerned with the legal aspects of it, I wouldn't be able to do the, like, important day-to-day aspects that I think are going to have a bigger, bigger impact on her life. Mm. Which is not to say that, like, not being legally recognized as your child's parent isn't important. It is really important, and New York is right now in the middle of like a long, big lawsuit about foster care, and it seems like a lot of the problems are in permanency, basically, like kids being in foster care for way, 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 way longer than they should be in foster care. And you know, the goal of foster care is supposed to be to achieve permanency for kids, which is just a euphemism for like making kids feel secure in a place and having that place be their permanent home. And that's really important to like a child's development, and of course it's really important in just like the stability of everybody's life involved. So it's not like, and usually that means either the child is reunified with their biological parent, or they're adopted by some foster parent or adoptive parent. But so it is really important. Like if you are a foster parent and you are locked in an endless bureaucratic nightmare with the city because you're not being recognized as the parent and you're constantly having to jump through these hoops, but there's no chance that this child is ever going to be reunited with their parents, like that is important. I think slash hope that that's the exception and not the rule.
Wow, so much here. I just want to go back to that Ema mommy moment. When you mentioned it, it's kind of like a nice, almost like quirky benefit of the kind of inhabiting a different culture than your foster child's parents and to some extent your foster child. And I wanted to know, it's like being like a Jewish mother, having a Jewish household, and these kids who are Jewish and something else when you're Jewish and not something else, and how do you think about that, like giving them identity, not boxing out other things, playing the long game for 15 or 18 years from now?
So there are actually some laws around this stuff. We are not actually allowed to formally give a foster child any kind of religious education. So like I couldn't sign her up for Hebrew school or something like that, and I think I probably wouldn't be allowed to send her to like a Jewish daycare. But that there isn't one for kids her age, so that's no problem. And her, so that aspect of it hasn't been hard for us to manage, but like obviously Jewish education isn't something that only happens in a classroom, and so like the other day when we were lighting Shabbat candles, I noticed that she was like going through the motions. Like she understood what was happening. She had expectations of what was going to happen next. And so like, and actually 2 days ago, I had an amazing moment, which I posted on Facebook, of she found a green onion in our CSA share and walked over to the dog and beat our dog with the green onion and sang Dayenu. And I was like, whoa, it really worked. I was like, that was exactly as memorable as you might expect that would be, I guess. So
I want to go to your Seder.
It was pretty good. So yeah, there was like this, she's clearly getting a Jewish education. We have been kind of trying to hold back from anything that would seem like formally instructive. But in this particular situation, we actually are going to be legally adopting her in just a few weeks. And that same afternoon, she'll be converted. So at that point, you know, we can do whatever we want and she will actually be Jewish. With our previous foster daughter, who was her Adira's first cousin, is interesting because her family has gotten more religious, and so we actually had an amazing moment where our former foster daughter and her mom so three generations of these women were at our house, and the grandmother heard something that made her realize that we weren't Christian, and she got really upset about it. And it was a little weird because, like, it's impossible for us to be on the down low about the fact that we're Jewish. Like, it's out and proud. And, like, her daughter has been at synagogue with us. Like, it's not, so it just it had not, like, trickled up to grandmother. Somehow, and it was a very awkward conversation where she was like, well, don't you believe in Jesus? And that wasn't a thing I ever anticipated talking about at my dining room table. But it was also this moment of us being like, don't worry, like we, you know, we didn't put this on your granddaughter when she, we were careful to kind of let her identity still be her identity. And when she was at our house, we were careful to like let her, when we were out, eat food that wasn't kosher. And like we had some across the street neighbors that have a like Christmas party where you sing a lot of Christmas carols, and like, I don't know if I would have gone to that if I didn't have a child who wasn't Jewish, but I was like, I think it's important that you like be part of this cultural experience that like might be a big part of your life when you're grown up, and like this isn't my thing, but like, you know what, it was totally wonderful. Christmas carols are great. So like, you know, it is awkward, and I don't feel like I have any great like, this is how you should do that. But I do feel like if you're not Jewish, then you should not be encumbered by Judaism. And so we have historically, and you know, in the future, whatever happens, we'll work to kind of have that be a thing, so that if there's a kid in our house and they are not Jewish, then we'll try and kind of support that to whatever degree it is. And we would even like, if the kid already had a religious identity, we have talked about like, we would take them to church, and we've like gotten recommendations of like churches that we might feel comfortable taking the kid to. So, you know, I don't know if that will ever happen, but it's something that we've discussed and said that we would do.
Amazing. So the law has come up a few times in terms of religious education, this goal of permanency. Could you give us a, like, take a step back and give us the lay of the land? What are the, where are the fault lines in the adoption fostering community right now? Where are the, like, kind of the activists versus other causes, and what are the issues at stake? And, you know, this is your chance to tell us your stance on these issues too.
So the main thing that happens in, so just to take a step back, like the way that fostering has entered the law was for the most part, kind of backwards. So it's not like a legal structure was set up and then a bunch of things came to be. Fostering, as far as I know, is something that was almost universally done by private, mostly religious institutions, starting roughly in the 19th century. And I mean, I think there were probably organizations doing it more informally before that, but there were formal institutions starting in the 19th century, and eventually the law caught up, and so legal structures were set up around that. As a result of that, there were some like very unsavory things that were kind of like vestiges of an earlier not legally bound system. So in New York in particular, most of the agencies that were set up to do foster care before it was like a legal thing were Jewish or Catholic. And they were set up mostly to take care of Jewish or Catholic children. And when they became part of this legal system, the way the system worked was a kid would go into care, and if the kid was Jewish, they would go to a Jewish agency, and if they were Catholic, they would go to a Catholic agency, and there were some other agencies of other religious affiliations, but not as many. And so, and the Jewish and Catholic agencies, they could take other kids, but they didn't have to if they didn't want to. And so they instituted what, as far as I know, was called the paper bag test, and it was like, actually, is this child darker than a paper bag? Then this agency isn't interested in them. And that was like a, it was just a thing, and it became, it was a terrible racist thing. And as a result, there would be a lot of kids in the system, mostly kids of color, who wouldn't be taken by any agency. And in New York, those kids were often sent to juvenile delinquent centers, not because they had done anything wrong, but because like that's where we could put them. We had a spot for them in a juvenile delinquent center, and nobody could take care of them otherwise. And so, like, as you might expect, kids who were for no reason sent to a juvenile delinquent center, like, they did not do well there. And juvenile delinquent centers aren't like great places to be either. So it was terrible. There was a long lawsuit that lasted like some 20 years and was actually adjudicated in large part by a Jewish judge, Justine Wise Polier, who was Rabbi Stephen S. Wise's daughter. And also, like, what an amazing name, Justine Wise. So awesome. And she was like a single woman. She was married and had children, but her husband died when he was very young, so she was raising her children by herself, and she was just an amazing, amazing woman. And she was part of this lawsuit that was eventually created, that eventually was settled to try and make the system itself less racist, with, I would say, middling results. Part of the issue that continues to this day is that they were trying to make it so these religious institutions couldn't discriminate based on religion. So if you were a Jewish system, you were just gonna have to take kids of all kinds. The problem was, there is one foster agency called Ohel that only deals with Haredi kids, kids who are ultra-Orthodox. And they said, we can't just take anyone, and our kids can't just go anywhere. Like, if a Haredi kid comes into the system, then they need to be placed in a home that is gonna have kosher food and that is going to kind of keep up their religious life in whatever way they're coming from. And because that had to be included, the whole ruling ended up being kind of watered down. And I think they're still dealing with the fallout of that today. I would say the like much bigger picture even than that thing that happens in foster care everywhere across the country and to some extent around the world is a kind of pendulum swinging between erring towards keeping children with their parents. There's pretty good statistical research that says that it's just better to keep kids with their parents. Even if their parents aren't doing a great job of keeping them safe, kids do better with their parents than with other people, versus the natural inclinations that people sometimes have when they see something unsafe to take kids out of their homes, their parents' care. And it's a pendulum swing because what happens is the system will say, do everything they can to keep kids in their parents' home. Then there will inevitably be a big case with a lot of media attention where there was a parent who was doing a lot of terrible things, the child who is being severely abused, usually the child dies, and then the pendulum will, as a result of outcry and legislation around that, the pendulum will swing towards taking kids out of homes as much as they can. Then there will be a case where it will show that a foster parent was abusing children and the child died, and then it will go back in the other direction. And that happens, I would say, about every 10 years in pretty much every city, the pendulum swings back and forth, and it's really unfortunate because, like, there's obviously, it seems clear to me that like it's best, if at all possible, to keep kids with their parents, because if you're putting them into this system, there's just inherent trauma. There's all kinds of things that can go wrong when you add all of these other factors. But if a child is being seriously abused, that's a good reason to take a child out of that situation. A big component in kind of like trying to figure out where to be on this pendulum swing or where to fall on any specific case is who is making that decision. In almost every city, it's a young woman right out of college who's being paid something like $25,000 a year and doesn't have any real training in anything. That's who has the job of looking into this most of the time. And so, in my opinion, the thing that we should be kind of investing in most seriously in terms of how to handle foster care is making sure that the people who are making these decisions have a lot of training and can also like see what the problem is. Like, is the problem that this is just like a really violent person who's really unstable? In that case, like, you can throw a lot of resources at that person, but like, unless they're gonna like go through like a really deep psychological change, they're probably gonna continue to be violent and it's not gonna be safe to have kids around there. But is this like, this is a situation of poverty. These parents are hitting their kids because they're really stressed out because they don't have enough money to feed all of their kids. Then the situation could easily be addressed by giving these people some more money and making sure that they have enough food to feed all their kids. And I think that like, it's a lot of intersecting issues that we don't really address them all.
Wow, amazing, amazing. I see the question cards are starting to come around.
I said something about the racist thing.
Andrew, can you tell us how we want to hear from you all now, so I want to hear, tell us how this is going to happen, Andrew.
There are cards and pencils on your tables. If you have a question, I'm happy to come collect it and bring it up.
Great.
Jason.
Okay.
This is a question. It's a story about the racist situation in New York City in history. My mother had a very blonde first cousin. So the reason she had a very blonde first cousin, her aunt and uncle wanted to adopt the baby. And they had a baby, they were in the process of adopting, and just when they were ready to adopt, it somehow came out, this was a mixed race child, and they took the child away from them. So you can't adopt this child because it's mixed race. It was in the late 20s probably. And so then the next time they said, I want a very blonde child so there'll be no question. So they didn't want the child taken away from them. So that's how my mother ended up with it. She's now 80 years old and she's not blonde anymore. But my mother had a very blonde first cousin because of the racist practices in New York State.
That's very, very sad.
So here's our first question, which is something I've been asking you about. How can non-foster parents support children in the foster system?
So this is a good question. I don't think everyone should be a foster parent. It's not like a super easy thing. But I do, like, if you're curious about it, if you feel kind of like, oh, maybe I could be interested in that, like, come talk to me after this. Like, I will have coffee with you and talk to you and give you the real talk about what it's really like and what's great about it and what's hard about it. But if that's not where you are, where you think you're going to be, there are a lot of ways that I think you can be involved. And, like, it really depends, as with all things, is, like, get involved where you think you can help most. So if you have, like, legal skills, then there are opportunities for people to represent foster children in court. In New York, this may not be a thing, but in Philadelphia, if either of the parents of the child have ever been represented by a public defender, then the public defenders who usually represent children won't represent the children. So they conflict out of the case. So then they need volunteer lawyers to step in and represent the children, which seems, I can tell you that my foster daughter's lawyer is a lawyer for SEPTA, which is like our MTA in Philadelphia, and I would love it if she was somebody with a little bit more legal expertise than that. So if you have legal expertise and that's something that you're interested in, that's one way of doing it. But the other thing is, like, if you're somebody who's really, there's a lot of mentorship programs which are really, really important, especially for older kids in the system. If you could be somebody who isn't a foster parent, but is like a person who has a relationship with the kid in the system, so they feel like they have an adult who can look out for them to some extent, and there's, like, varying degrees of what that can mean. You can, like, mentor them in basic life skills. They probably don't necessarily have someone in their life who will teach them about, like, what do you need if you want to get a loan so you can go to college, or what do you need if you want to just, like, have an appropriate job interview. All kinds of things that you may have learned relatively intuitively from people in your life that they may not have people around to do. If you're interested in giving money, there's a great organization called Treehouse that does a lot of foster care advocacy. And there's a lot of, in different communities, no matter where you live, there's almost always like a foster agency that will have a closet where you can donate clothes, books, diapers, wipes, all kinds of things that foster children and foster families might need. The other thing is just, like, be supportive of foster families in your community. We've been really lucky that we just have had a lot of people in our community help us in all kinds of ways and be really supportive of us. And that has made a really big difference in our feeling like we can do this. I think if people didn't know that we were fostering or seemed hostile to it, which is in some communities that is the response that people have gotten, then I think it would have been, like, significantly harder for us to do this.
We got a question more personally. You mentioned that in a couple weeks, Adira is going to be kind of moved from being your foster daughter to your adoptive daughter. And I wanted to hear, like, what's that process been like for you? And It seems like a huge shift in the relationship that kind of might, she might leave your care to one that'll be lifelong.
So it is weirdly not that much of a shift because the wheels of the legal system move so slowly that it's been clear that we would adopt her for almost a year, even more than that. And she just turned two. So it's been a long time that we knew that this was likely going to happen. But it's certainly not going to have any impact on our day-to-day lives at all, I don't think, except, oh my God, we're not going to have social worker visits. It's going to be so wonderful. Yeah. This week we just had the last visit from one of the many social workers, and I was like, wow, I never thought about the day when there wouldn't be more people coming to our house at 8 a.m. So it's not going to affect things like in a day-to-day level almost at all, I think. But it's really a question of like, oh, once we adopt her, then everything is up to us. Like, we can decide. Right now, there are some rules about things that we can and can't do. And once we adopt her, then the system is basically gone from our lives. But for us, people make different decisions, but we have really committed to making sure that she has a relationship with her mom in whatever way that is her mom is capable of having at this point. And so that's gonna kind of, I think, continue to be something that's in flux. We are really lucky that with our first foster daughter, we have a like super strong relationship with her and her whole family. Still, and actually just this past Friday, I drove out to Virginia where she lives now because her mom was about to have a baby. And so I stayed with Zamaya while her mom had the baby, and then I got to take her to meet her baby brother. So that was just like a really wonderful thing and a testament, I think, to like how much we have all as a kind of big unit of people worked to keep a strong relationship going. And that's gonna be something that we're gonna have to continue to do. In general, the system of like moving from fostering to adopting, it's just like very different from kid to kid because it depends a lot on like how much work a parent is doing to try and get their child back and how much help they're getting. And you can have all kinds of issues like, is the parent incarcerated? Is the parent in treatment? Is the parent getting mental health services? And is the parent in poverty? All these things are, I think, those are the most frequent issues that kind of intersect with whether or not somebody is going to be able to be reunited with their child.
Just one last question for you. You have, you know, dozens of people here in this room. You have thousands of people on our iTunes feed. What do you want to say to them?
I think that the thing I didn't realize at all when I got into being, when I started thinking about fostering and when I became a foster parent is how much, I mean, it's really obvious, but I just hadn't thought about it, how much foster care is something that intersects so closely with poverty and addiction and mental health. And if there's almost no situation in which a child would go into foster care that doesn't intersect with one or more than one of those three things. And so if you really want to help foster children and you don't want to become a foster parent, then working on any of those issues in your community is the best thing that you can do. And I don't know how often anyone in this room thinks about the opioid epidemic that's happening in our country right now, but it is a really terrifying problem. It is extremely far-reaching. For what it's worth, it is reaching mostly white people, and it is something that we as a society need to come to terms with, I think, and be serious about fixing. And that means, I think, treating addiction in a very different way than we have up until now. And so for whatever, however it happened, like, I think that my thing that I can do is just, like, extreme nurturing. and I think that that is something that, like, this is my thing that I got when people got gifts, like, that's the thing that I got, and I didn't get, like, remembering birthdays. But if your thing isn't extreme nurturing, like, if your thing is, like, angry letter writing, like, this is an opportunity for you. And if your thing is, you know, like, deep philosophical questions, like, there are some deep philosophical questions here. And I think just at this moment, thinking about the way that you can be of service to our country, which is, I think, suffering from these big, important issues of poverty, addiction, and mental health, the lack of mental health services in this country, that is something that we can all, like, do. And even if you, like, aren't gonna take up arms for this today, just, like, being aware that these are the things that are causing a huge amount of the trauma in this country is useful. And hopefully it will make some difference.
Great. Let me say again, thank you so much to Tamar for coming. You know, I think if we were to draw one thread from the Torah to, you know, right now, extreme nurturing is not a bad one to draw up and really hold out. And I really feel like this evening we've been trying to put forward two messages, which are really one. The first is, you know, when you stop for a moment to look, the urgency of and the poignancy of caring for children and the care they need is actually one of the central themes of the Torah, not just in those, you know, 18 places where God says, take care of them, but also, like, in statement after statement, story after story, from Moses through other characters to us, right? That if we really approach the Torah with this theme, it becomes not just about ideas and not just about positions. It becomes about the extreme nurturing that children require. And the second is that the Torah really asks of us as individuals and as a community, asks is much too soft a word. The Torah cries out to us as individuals and as a community to see the care for vulnerable children as one of our central priorities, as one of the Torah's central priorities, one of the Jewish community's central priorities, one of God's central priorities. And I think oftentimes, you know, we focus on these, you know, more symbolic acts that happen more at a distance, you know, of giving money and certain causes, maybe because they're easier to imagine ending them, maybe because it's too hard to confront how little we feel like we can do sometimes. And so I hope that this evening really is one moment of raising up the work of Tamar and other people as really kind of exemplary of and central to what we understand it means to be a Jewish community and the kind of Torah and Jewish life we're trying to create here at Hadar. And I want to thank you all for coming and being part of it.